Welcome to the Ecology Plus Design Podcast. I'm your host, Kendall Mainzer, and joining me is my co-host, Dr. Travis Floor.
Hello. Today, we'd like to welcome Jack Dangerman to our podcast.
For our listeners who might not know, Jack leads ESRI, the Environmental Systems Research Institute. Jack holds degrees in landscape architecture, environmental science, and urban and regional planning. In 1969, along with his wife, Laura, Jack founded ESRI, driven by the idea that computer-based mapping and analysis could make significant contributions to geographic planning and environmental science. In 50 years of steady growth, now ESRI includes 49 offices worldwide, 11 research centers, and serves more than 350,000 user organizations. Jack has been a fervent supporter of using geographic information science, or GIS, for the benefit of communities and the environment.
Just as a side note, a more personal note about Jack is Jack loves plants. It comes from a long family history of landscape architecture has a plant nursery within his family. But also he just loves planting trees. And if you ever visit ESRI's corporate office in Redlands, the landscape there is immaculate. It's amazing. And Jack takes it to heart about the environmental science and particular plants and landscape architecture.
Welcome, Jack. We're grateful for your time with us today.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you for being here, Jack.
Yeah, thanks. So really we wanted to pick your brain, so to speak, on you have a very different perspective than many of us have. Being in academia, I worked for a small landscape architecture civil engineering firm, about 20 people. Was kind of my first introduction to GIS. We used it a little bit, not as much as I had wanted, which has led me back to school in academia. But we wanted to get your perspective on some of these global issues, whether it be climate change, biodiversity loss, and not only hear what ESRI is doing, but what, from your personal perspective, but also from ESRI's perspective, what we could be doing better as academics, or what are some of the barriers to that deep integration of ecology within the design professions?
Well, I think landscape architecture is the right discipline to do the integration of geospatial science, basically all of the ologies, biology, hydrology, geology, etc., with the design practice. The ability to geodesign things into existence and make them come into existence in a professional environment. The irony for me is that most of the landscape architecture professionals who are doing practice are hired or commissioned to do work largely by the developers and occasionally in public service, like parks or open space planning. But most of the reasons why firms are hired like the one that you are in is to do landscaping or designing around a particular development project or accommodating a particular development project which somebody else made a decision about. So as we look broadly at the world, population is increasing. It's been exponentially increasing for my entire career. We saw this in the 1960s with the books of Paul Ehrlich, Population Bomb. We saw the environmental alerting by people like Rachel Carson, the Silent Spring. We saw it in the early writings and practices of landscape planners like Ian McCarg. They laid the footprints down for the visioning of integrating science in as a guiding framework into making spatial designs and making landscape and urban development around it sustainable. The unfortunate situation is that the actual profession of landscape architecture and even urban planning is largely limited in what it can actually do to address the big problem of integrating science into decision making. That's frustrating to me. So I actually left the profession of landscape architecture. I guess it's okay after 50 years to say that. And became very attracted to geography and being able to digitally automate or transform geographic phenomena into the computer to make maps and also do spatial analytics. And this was very attractive to people beyond landscape architecture who needed to do spatial planning. In the private sector, they were commercial companies like Starbucks or McDonald's or Walmart or these big developers who want to pick the right location for doing business. And also for oil companies who want to drill in the right location. But I was able to bring into their thinking the consideration of ecology or layers. They weren't exactly landscape architects, but they made decisions which were spatial, and they began to realize over the years that environment really mattered. So today you see many very large corporations actually lay down a environmental framework for their spatial decision making. And I wouldn't call it design, I would simply say it's a calibration of their action based on considering dimensions that we all care about. In the public sector, which is dominates the world of geospatial and GIS thinking, we see much more receptivity, and that is in the area of environmental conservation in big agencies like the Forest Service or EPA or BLM or Department of Agriculture. There they have embraced the tools of GIS for managing their systems of record keeping, but also doing spatial analytics to be able to support the kinds of decisions that are interesting to landscape architects. But back to this fundamental quandary that most landscape firms historically have not been asked to do the right thing. So what can landscape architects do, really? Well, I have a few thoughts. They certainly have to be aware of the absolute necessity at this point in history of integrating biodiversity thinking into their practices on both the conservation side and also advocating green infrastructure as a foundation for livable cities. Places like Singapore have certainly distinguished themselves, some people say even gone overboard and greening everything up. But it's delightful to be there as a human experience. And ecologically, it's making a difference in biodiversity in the city and also in cooling the city by several degrees. So that's a lot that landscape architects can advocate and push for. They need to be aware of it, and they need to keep telling the story of what's possible, attempting to integrate better nature and design thinking in their practices. They also have to be advocates without being radical. That's my entire life. I was never attracted to go to the right or go to the left based on politics or that sort of thing. I was attracted to try to push for rational thinking and science integrated into the way that people behave. And ultimately, that translates into design. So being able to be a firm which is distinguished based on we use good information, good modeling, good science as part of our practice. Well, okay, a few firms did that from time to time during the 70s or 80s. But I'm talking about now, we have to go big. And that means really every landscape architect as a profession needs to be able to understand both and be grounded in the, I don't want to be alarmist, but it's literally crisis level of loss of biodiversity and climate change that's going on around us. We need to be aware of it, and we need to be equipped with solutions that can really address those in very specific ways.
Well, that's something that we did definitely want to speak with you about today, because as we mentioned in our brief, the recent UN climate reports document climate change is accelerating beyond the predicted models. When the models under-predict, how does ESRI seek to provide tools, provide response to better support the landscape architects, the other professionals who are trying to provide solutions? Specifically, when at Penn State, we are starting this group, this Ecology Plus Design group, with the intention that we need to better understand science at a deeper level as designers before we start coming up with solutions that can scale up and down. So we're seeking to sort of integrate it two flashpoints, right? We've got two inflection points that we're reaching for. How does Esri serve its users in when the models, I mean, we haven't responded in the ways we've been called to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, like if the models are under-predicting and we're entering a world, or in academia at least, we often look to historical precedents. But there really isn't historical precedence for this in many regards. And so my understanding is Esri is not the one doing the models. They're providing the tools for the people doing the model making.
Right.
But have you been engaged in conversations as either as a personal, because you travel a lot and meet a lot of different people, or as a company when you begin to really scale or edit and change the models at the pace we need to change them?
Yeah, let's just start with what is Esri? It's a tool builder.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. And we try while building our tools, or we work while building our tools on also enabling them to address some of the larger challenges that are facing us, things like climate change. But we ourselves are in service to our users, and they are driven by policymakers. They're driven by mandates that they're required to carry out, by economic forces that push them in this way or that way. Having said that, we're just people here, the three of us, and we're thinking about what is it that's going to address the greater challenges on the planet. Wow, that's a big deal. So in my own little personal ways, I start by planting trees. I'm a tree planting fanatic and try to do these small things. Also, I advocate for green infrastructure and conservation wherever I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to do my own part in that. And then scaling up from that, I try to talk to people who are our users to get them to wake up and understand the larger context of what's occurring on the planet. And yeah, in the last 50 years, since I've been doing my work, since I started Esri, we have lost roughly 3 billion birds. And that's not only abundance, it's also putting on the edge particular species. So those are the two dimensions of the bird phenomena. That's a parakeet in a coal mine, so to speak, because the fragility of the plant environment and ecosystems that this signifies, the changes that have been made, the human footprint that's affected environment in these last 50 years is kind of overwhelming. I mean, it should alarm everybody. I mean, if we were just in a little boat here, the three of us, and it was leaking faster than we could bail it out, what would we do? And what people don't seem to realize, that is normal people, meaning like us, is the gravity of the situation. Scientists today say that we're about 1.7 overextended. What that means is we're consuming about 1.7 of the world's natural resources to support sustainability of life. Now, in our personal bank accounts, that wouldn't go very far if you were spending more money than you were getting in. We would go bankrupt pretty quickly. And at the global scale, this is approximately the level of overexpenditure of natural resources or natural capital that we're taking. We're taking too many fish out of the oceans, besides the fact that we're polluting it. We're cutting the tropical forests. We're destroying everything from big species to little things like nematodes, which are under our feet. We walk over them every day.
Yes.
But they're the things that sustain life. They're doing all this amazing work for us so that we can breathe and enjoy a good life. And then there's this dimension that here in North America and Europe, we're ourselves consuming proportionally much more than the developing world. So if we let everybody live like us, it's amazing we'd blink out really quickly. So if you look through geologic time at the very slow increase of life that occurred, there were a few big moments where biodiversity and life itself really accelerated. And one of those was when there was enough atmosphere that more life could be sustained. We should think about that today. Because as you peel back the protective layers of our atmosphere, what happens to biodiversity? The second one is when light was when seeing was invented, some hundreds of millions of years ago. Seeing was invented. If I was reading the New York Times, it would say, seeing was invented. Yeah. And when that happened, it started the sort of predator-prey relationship. Little amoebas were able to see each other. When they saw light, they saw things, movement. And the evolution of the species really accelerated because you could see prey and go after them. And that resulted in a very rapid acceleration of biodiversity. New species were in, survival of the fittest kicked in, Darwinism kicked in, and life expanded both in numbers and diversity. And today, interestingly enough, we are reinventing that moment in the form of AI and machine learning and new observational stuff. I mean, people talk a lot about these autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. They're actually things that can see. We've invented a new way of seeing. And where does that take us? These vehicles are they going to take over where humans can't live? It's a fundamental interesting question because they're definitely accelerating very rapidly. So I'm giving this as background because as humans develop new technology, it enables our ability to consume more. So there's a kind of co-evolution that goes on with every new invention of tool or method. There's a reaction, kind of co-evolution reaction in human survival or the good life. And we have benefited from this enormously. In healthcare, we benefited in better forms of living, of energy, of the good life. Mm-hmm. Compared to my parents' life when they were born, it's enormously different. So on one hand, this co-evolution is making our lives seemingly better. On the other hand, it's ignoring the fundamental infrastructure of this first form of infrastructure, our natural infrastructure. And we pretend that it isn't fading away. But if it fades away, we're doomed. So how do we combat this this dilemma of consuming more than we have, but also continuing to accelerate in our innovation, see new things, create new ways of being, and pretend that we don't have to deal with living infrastructure? For me, who's going to take on that job? Who's going to sort of bring it out and show from a geo-accounting perspective what we're doing? Well, some people like the SDG indicators doing geo-accounting for the planet. This is one dimension of it. But largely, government institutions, private institutions, continue to work on their own little stovepipe of optimization. Thus the dilemma with landscape architects. They're hired by people that are working on narrow slices of reality, not holism. So is it going to be politicians who see the whole and what's happening? Is it going to be company presidents that see the whole? They wake up and they change radically their behavior as organizations. Is it going to be the our state governors or our city leaders or our, when it gets, as you peel it back, there doesn't seem to be in big institutions that are going to do this. It seems to be more small collectives that are friends. They form little clubs. They might want to do something together. Mm-hmm. They can work together to create movements. You know, movements like Al-Qaeda or movements like the Silent Spring, we can actually talk about because they showed up in our lifetime. They were not one massive thing. They were small cells of people that really understood the situation, in those cases radicalism, but similarly in positive vein things like the farmer, you know, local farmer movement, local food. They're small cells that work semi-independently but have a broad vision of what must be done. So in thinking about this, and I've done a lot of this, is who's going to create the kind of lower level spontaneous reaction that actually gets us to approach problem solving in a global way. I think it's small groups. Going back to landscape architects, they're so equipped because they have to study the science side and the design side. They are geospatial problem solvers. So what better group than LA's to pick up this idea and operate locally? So that's always been the thought that's been in my mind, is they could be catalyzed and work as not as big machines, but as small little groups. I mean, actually, if you study landscape architecture firms, I haven't looked at it recently. There's a few big ones, but most of them are small little 11-person companies, 7 to 12 people.
Yeah, Stephen and Kendall have in the past for research about who our alums are and who are we providing students to have looked, and most of the ASLA work plus the work they've done is, yeah, they're firms of 5 to 11 people. Yeah. In some cases, we have way more sole practitioners than the AECOMs of the world.
Oh, yeah.
And
there's nothing wrong with those big companies, but when you have small firms, they can retain their soul. They're not bought by a money machine or operate under, you know, a large dogma of make money. They can not only help their clients create better solutions, but they also are equipped to, at the same time, tell stories in a non-political or maybe political environment that deals with addressing the greater challenges that are facing all of us. So I have this love of landscape architects in small practices.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a lot when I was reading Inc's interview with you about the successes, that you've never had a bad quarter with Esri, that a lot of what you attributed your success to was staying private and staying, while you're not small, 350,000 users worldwide, you, at the time of that press, you have been able to be more responsive instead of to shareholders, instead of to the big money making, which you indicated was one of the issues that directs. Landscape architecture is often defined by political powers. I know Travis and Stephen, both in their work, are really interested in who's the decision dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Politics, yeah. Driving what can we do, even as we seek with our researchers, with Dr. Wu Hong, Dr. Andy Cole, they're looking at, you know, understanding these deep considerations.
Mm-hmm.
Each of you do that as well, but then considering what can we do with the information we're receiving.
Look, from my perspective, it's all okay. We're living in a complex world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's public sector, private sector, there's public companies. They're all part of our ecosystem.
Right.
For my own personal life, for a variety of reasons, I chose not to borrow money or to become part of another firm. And I suppose that has resulted in me having the ability to do certain things that others haven't. So I don't want to advocate it too heavily because the world is what it is.
Right, but there are lessons to be learned there.
But for me, it has allowed me the opportunity to focus clearly on doing what my customers really need to have done. And sometimes that isn't work for hire. It's not like they hire me to do this thing. I can look at what they need and try to engineer holistic solutions that address the kind of challenges that they are facing. And so I'll take requirements and listen to them, and sometimes several years later it'll show up in a tool that we build. So it's a slow process. Geodesign is not a perfect set of software tools that we have.
Sure.
You know this from your real experience. But I'm working on it.
Yeah.
And the general frame of it, linking the science side to the design side, is going to be done by lots of different technologies. Mm-hmm. I just want to be able to articulate that well and do it well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe we will fail.
I think being, as a designer in me, I'm always optimistic. And yes, to some regard, I think we would, as a designer, I think you have to be, because you're imagining a future.
That's better.
And so that's better. And so
the future that I imagined 50 years ago is still the future that I imagine today. Philosophically, the world is designed to grow. That's how we've wired it up. Mm-hmm. And people, you all want to make sure that the companies you invest in with your 401k make sure that they're earning money. So you've got to play to that. As designers, as professionals, you have to play to that mentality. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's the head of China or the head of this country or EU, everybody wants growth, don't they? So how can we have sustainable prosperity? Those are the two words that I've come to recently, but they reflect everything I've ever thought about. How can we support the idea of getting better, you know, but at the same time create getting better being sustainable, so that every advance that we make reflects all of the implications of externalities, the non-monetary stuff like biodiversity that we all aspire to want to take care of. So those two words, at least right now, are playing big in my mind.
It's interesting that you're talking about the idea that those things can work together, sustainable prosperity.
Maybe it can't. I have that thought too.
But. So I had read earlier that President Xi Jinping had said back in 2013 about China transitioning so China should transition from a GDP-focused civilization to an ecological civilization. Is that an either-or in your mind, or is there some overlap there?
Well, considering the complexity of what's going on in our world today, troubles me. It's too complex. It's not either or. It's just, look, ecology is complex. We know that.
Yeah.
And humans in the ecology is even more complex. And the dynamics of greed and economic prosperity are in direct conflict at times with the ability to sustain the planet. And it's those challenges that the geodesigner or the landscape architect is sort of often commissioned to deal with. Can you help me get approval on this project so we can work around the environmental situation or the environmental laws? Sometimes it's worth them saying, no, this project is bullshit. You can't do it. Right? And that's very hard to do when you're struggling in a practice to do the right thing. It's really difficult.
Sure. We do train our students on advocacy at some level of understanding.
I was going to say that was one of the things that you mentioned that I personally take to heart, and I have come to it lately, is that there's the personal thing we can do, mm-hmm. and that's for you. It's been planting trees and amongst, I'm sure, other things. So it's advocating to the students that yes, there is a professional, but there's a personal, and often in the problems that we're trying to solve, it also can't be an either or. It's a more holistic, what you do personally, what you do professionally, what you do for your firm, what you do in these collectives that you're speaking of. And then for me, I think it was there was a group out of UPenn that did the Landscape Architecture Manifesto recently, where there's a small I don't want to say a faction, but a small group within the broader profession of landscape architecture that has said to tackle these things, we must be more proactive. But that doesn't mean we put students into traditional practice. We should be building landscape architecture students with the knowledge base to become the city planner, working with planning, to go into politics, to go into nonprofits, and to open what our vision or our perception of what landscape architects are capable of, so that way they are jointly writing policy or driving mandates of agencies, such, you know, as the the Department of Ag, I think, employs the most landscape architects, like
Forest Service,
yeah, and so that they then become the people driving some of these policies and mandates to help bring those perspectives that we have in the design world into the rule set that we're often playing by, or that are driving some of the non-economic decisions, but the governmental decisions.
It's hard.
And so it's hard, yeah.
You have to make a living.
Yes.
That's sort of what people fall back on. And so it's important that we understand it, but at the same time, by coloring yourself either on the right or the left, what happens is then your word is not as trusted or acknowledged in the broader environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I a Republican or am I a Democrat? Depending upon the answer, everything is filtered in your mind mm-hmm. about what I say.
Yeah.
So I remain an independent. Okay, that's weird. So that's also coloring.
Mm-hmm.
So your footprints of your work color how people perceive you.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my space, speaking as a business person, I work very hard to avoid politicalizing, advocating this versus that, but rather let rational thinking and science speak
mm-hmm.
for itself. So I like to build tools that help people do their work better and bring science and systems analysis and systematic thinking into their work and not get overly embedded in my professional life into this or that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also don't like to become politically active in this or that. I like to myself personally do work, which I mm-hmm. work at fanatically, but I don't know that I want to put a spin on it.
Sure.
Like this is the right way or that's the right way. I just do my work, plant trees, create parks, create preserves, talk about them, talk about the meaning of it.
You do come across saying making a difference is important to you. It's throughout any interview I've seen, a lot of what Esri talks about when they talk about you as the founder, it's about the idea that you can make a difference, that your tools can help to solve great problems.
Well, we certainly have that belief that systematic, science-based tools can make a difference in decision-making. And whether it's in shutting down Ebola or whether it's, you know, locating a new town in the wilderness or whether it's protecting a reserve or whether it's, you know, dealing with armed social conflict or policing, there's no question in my mind that database-driven, science, rational thinking can make a difference in the outcomes. They can normally create better outcomes. That's very true. But when I think about making a difference, people have different perceptions of that. So let me make that more real. All of us think about the future, right? So what's next in the future? What's next for you personally? What's next for you and your family? What's next for your community here in, I want to say Penn, but it's
State
really
College, yeah.
State College, right? Yeah, that's a joke.
Yeah.
What's next for the university? What's next for the state of Pennsylvania? What's next for our country, and what's next for our world. Each of those different scales of context, when you ask the question, and you do it personally, has different meaning. And some of them are very abstract, like the whole world. Some of them are very personable, like I'm going to get married or I'm going to have a child or like that. So in thinking through going all in on something, most of us go all in on our personal lives. Some of us don't. Some people go all in on the university or into national politics. They go all in on trying to make the country better, or some of them go all in on looking at life and its continuation on the planet. We hear a lot of that today, considering the challenges that are there. So making a difference, you have to choose. You can't do it all. So where do you focus? Where do landscape architects as professionals focus? Where do architects focus? Where do any of us focus on our community? Developing a community group? Do we make something up? Do we join another organization? I'm talking abstractly here purposely just to get you thinking that what one person says can be misinterpreted. I want to make a difference with my life. I want to play it 100%. This is clear with me, and I suspect clear with most people. But what do they want to make a difference on with? What is going to be the substantive meaning? What does it mean to have a purposeful life where you go all in on something? Well, that changes based on the personality and the context that we all live in. For me, I think it's clear what my life has been and will continue to be until I blink out. I really like the idea of bringing science and the natural world into the way that people behave. That's sort of the bottom line. It's not a mystery or a saying or some mysterious thing. It's just something that I do.
So, and you've done it well, but how?
Yeah. Well, not always. I mean, I make mistakes all along the way. There's 1,000 mistakes that I've made.
We're trying to learn from some of your successes, though, too, while we're here. And
I'm not so special, frankly. I have been lucky and fortunate to have a couple of basic philosophies that I've adhered to. But I'm not that smart, and I've sort of moved into circumstances that allowed me to do what I did. I suspect that any rational person would have done similar things.
Well, so some similarities for our group, trying to integrate ecology and design in Penn State. Right. And we hosted a symposium 2 years ago. We brought together thinkers from across the country who have been asking this question for at least 20 or 30 years about how to do it better. We still felt like there was a need, that we were wondering if there was an appetite for it. And we asked, quite frankly, and we continue to ask, how do we go over the barriers?
You mean, is there a market for it?
Well, that also, but how do you, we know there are barriers to it, or else we'd be doing it. How if you have research-based solutions, Esri is very interested in understanding how science can inform the tools.
Yes.
How do you integrate ecology into design? How does ecology come to your tools?
Well, as a student, I was attracted to it. I just liked it, and I can't tell you why. But one of my professors, Howard Fisher, and I worked in his lab at Harvard. He was also the sort of one of the people that Carl Steinitz worked under. Mm-hmm. After watching me for about a year, he said, "You know, Jack, there's people that I've worked with that really are interested in research and writing and teaching, and there's people that want to do applied work. And I notice that you can do both, but you're really very good at applied." And I'd say that was one of the decisions that I sort of came to in that year of my education, is I really want to apply the science and the technology to real problem solving. I really love that idea. So when I went back to California, I started Esri just doing application work, not, and I used the money that I made out of the applications to fund the technology.
But how do you go back to the life sciences, the ecological sciences, the forestry, ecology itself, biological sciences, environmental science, the different fields? How do you go back to them to apply what they're learning? Those researchers are dedicating their lives to better understanding the problems that exist, both across systems and deeper.
Well, I guess the practical solution for me was, after working with homemade tools for about 10 years, which was the first 10 years of ESRI, we started to build generic toolkits that could be useful in biology and in hydrology and in geology and in urban planning and in the military and in forestry and virtually everything mm-hmm. else. And I sold those toolkits to people so that they could do their work better in each of those disciplines. It's built on the idea that geography as a fundamental science can not only be interesting in and of itself, but it also is, from my perspective, the mother of all the other sciences. So, interestingly enough, in the early days, we would put all these different layers of information into a database for doing a project better. We'd gather the recent data, and then you could overlay the maps, and you could do suitabilities, and blah, blah, blah. Today, I have these millions of users who are building databases in different disciplines, and through the magic of web services, we're able to expose those individual data sets and integrate them dynamically. It's like dynamically bringing data out of everybody else's ology database and overlay them across the web. It's like magic. It's like plastic overlays dynamically brought out of people's own individual sciences and fused using the power of location. So in the early days, we had to put everything into a mainframe computer, and then we did it on mini computers, then we did it on workstations. We brought data together, overlaid the maps, and we could do some integrated thinking. We could see the whole out of the parts. Today, what's happening is the magic of distributed servers that are interconnected through the web. I can pull the data together dynamically and see the whole. And this is just the very beginning light of what that will be like. I mean, I imagine Thomas Edison, when he first, built the first light bulb, it's a little light, you can think of it in your head. Today, you can look at the world at night and you see the interconnectedness of all of humanity through light. The same transformation is happening with GIS. In the beginning, we could do one project at a time. It was a magnificent light bulb. This was 50 years ago. We could do suitability analysis. Today, what we're seeing is the interconnection of all those separate sciences with live data, IoT data, systematic data from remote sensing, all coming together over the web. I can overlay and I can provide a new kind of enlightenment for the world. So it's lighting up the world to the same fabric as world at night. And this fabric, this infrastructure, I like to call it geospatial infrastructure, is an evolutionary step that will be the ability for people to see and avoid footprinting on parts of the fabric which are so sensitive, the highly diverse biodiversity areas. And they will be able to see what they're doing. They'll be able to see what they're doing to climate and see what they're doing on many frontiers. So geospatial is about to have a huge and expanding role in the evolution of where humans go, but also the evolution of the planet itself.
Yeah, the takeaway for me is that it's instilling in our students that it's not just a professional pathway, but also there's personal things that people can do. And it's finding that, as you mentioned, there's like that niche, the thing that you're passionate about and where you want to spend your energy. And through their curriculum here and trying to build that, as a way to just integrate our ecology and design.
I think it's a nice way to abstract it, actually, to sort of summarize the discussion as life is not about just the profession or just one aspect of the profession or just one kind of practice, but I really want your students to see both the content of their work, the specific things that they learn through their career here as a student, but also beyond, but also the context that brings it all together. Yeah. And this interplay between content in the learning cycle or content in geography or content in geodesign versus context of the meaning of why you're doing it in the first place is very interesting and dynamic and cause to think. I mean, I think geography, in a sense, is a science of both content and context.
Absolutely.
It helps us see the context, but also integrates all the content of the planet and everything that we do. And for me, that has always been its attraction. And speaking about our users, what I've noticed about them is that they continue learning in many professions. People, you know, learn how to do it, like measurement. They learn all about how to do measurement. And that's it. That's their whole life. Or they're just about modeling or one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. And in the case of GIS, the invention of new tools and new methods keeps people learning because it's growing. I mean, last year we spent $350 million on R&D. We spend about a third of our revenue on R&D, and that goes into building new tools. And just like when you were to learn a new word, you add one more word to your vocabulary, it enriches, you know, the little synapses in your brain. You suddenly expand intellectually. Same thing, I think, in the evolution of geospatial technologies. As we add new methods, as we add new tools, new methods emerge, new methods cause new understanding. New understanding causes changes in human behavior. So this vision of being able to bring together the ologies across the web and fuse them dynamically is immensely interesting to people because they long to know and understand things. I mean, most of us walk around, we don't understand much, really. We pretend that we do. But the idea of fusing different disciplines and the analytics of that to create understanding, this is attractive. And whether it's at the technical level, people learn new tools, or at the contextual level, people see new methods emerging. Through my entire career, I've never seen it slow down, and I've never seen it, and it's exponentially growing. Now that it's in the hands of young kids, the idea of learning in school at a high school level, the same tools that a PhD student learned just 10 years ago, you know, collecting data about their neighborhoods or about social discourse or use of drugs in their high schools, them measuring it and analyzing it and then solving the problems using GIS is amazing. So, I think it will transform ultimately through the evolution of the technology. In this case, it'll be a positive force to create this sort of sustainable prosperity. Prosperity doesn't necessarily mean wealth either. It can be just a more prosperous life, a more life of better understanding and better navigation.
It certainly supports what we're trying to do with fusing these values of understanding all the dynamic fusion of the ologies.
Yes.
You know, it helps give us some great support to what we're trying to do here. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jack.
You're welcome. Yeah.